Howard Lindzen is the founder and general partner at Social Leverage. All opinions expressed by Howard and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Social Leverage or StockTwits. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon for decisions. Guests may maintain positions and securities discussed in this podcast.
K-Nut.
Hey, how are you, Howard?
I am a little upset. You said take the Jolly Rancher sucker out of my mouth.
That's upsetting. I can understand.
There's nothing like a Jolly Rancher, especially after a meal. Here's a little secret after 97,000 podcasts about Howard Lindzen. Howard Lindzen loves candy. Did you know that?
You sucker for a sucker?
Hey, oh, dude, please. There's so much lost in your humor in the translation. So everybody knows the Canute is at its best when he laughs at my silliness, correct?
Well, not everybody thinks that, but that's okay.
I swear to God, here's what I got going right. I got a cigarette, a shot of tequila, and I just had sushi at Hane with Ellen.
Nice.
Oh, so good. And so I like sugar the way some people like to smoke after a meal. I like to smoke too after a meal, and I have a cigar, and I have a sucker and candy, and it just gets out of control. So I found these Jolly Ranchers. And the problem with Jolly Rancher and every candy manufacturer in the whole wide world is there's only one good flavor, cherry. Yet they throw in six other flavors into all these packs. So you're getting like 86% bad flavors.
So do you eat the other five or do you give them away?
No, it costs me a lot of money to have candy because I can only really go to a candy store, which luckily Coronado has Fuzzy Wigs, where I just make red bags of candy.
This is a business model here.
This is a complete business model. And the other thing about red is cinnamon's worse than the other colors. So like red can be like a complete, someone wants to mess with me. They stick a few fireballs or cinnamon things into my cherry blasts and all hell breaks loose. So it's a very complicated life is what I'm getting around.
I think a lot of the listeners are sympathizing with your problems, Howard.
Hence I'm sucking on a Jolly Rancher. Speaking of, there's no segue here. So today I'm really excited. I actually took notes. This is how complicated and intelligent a person I have on today. Alex Danko, one of my new favorite writers. I'm sure he's been writing forever, but I feel like I only recently in the last year or so got into his writing and sharing his writing. He has a Substack, because who doesn't? And worked at Social Capital, not to be confused with Social Leverage. I think Chamath stole our name, but made a lot more money off it than I can. And then left Social Capital. They broke up. It's like the Beatles, except with no musical talent. They broke up. And Alex back in Toronto, and he now is head of Shopify Money. And no one likes Shopify or has done as well riding that stock as me. I think even you know what Shopify is.
I do.
So Alex took a role running Money, which is their money product, which is probably lending and crypto and thinking all through how their vendors can collect money. And so I'm really excited. What about you?
I am. That sounds really good.
So we're going to talk about crypto, trading, Canada, startups, debt financing.
Jolly Ranchers.
No, because you're not even into candy.
Oh, I am.
I think the only store I would run... I would weigh seven. You'd have to visualize 700-pound Howard with one tooth. It's just a red only candy store. It's kind of like my Moobs idea. By the way, I think it could work on DTC. So remind me to ask Alex at the end, because generally I ask you, do you have questions? So this would be your question: could you do a red only Shopify candy store?
Okay, sounds good. I'm taking.
That's notes something that I want to put on the list. Okay. Anyways, right. Let's get Alex on the phone.
Sounds like a plan.
Hello.
Alex Danko.
Howard, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm in San Diego. You were in Toronto, or were you Ottawa?
I'm in Toronto. That's right.
Were you born in Toronto?
No, I'm American originally. My mom's a Quebecer and my dad's American. So I grew up in Vermont. That was the compromise.
So you made the big move for Shopify?
Oh, no. I've lived in Canada for 15 years, almost 15 years. I went to McGill. I went up north of the border, moved to Montreal, where a bunch of my family is there, and it was McGill. It was a great place to be. You get to live in Montreal. You know, what's what not to love.
Fantastic food, and great summer. Winters from hell.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, it's not that different from Vermont. If you're used to one, you're used to the other.
So smoke meat.
Smoke meat. Okay.
Maybe one of the greatest human inventions.
One of the great inventions. Tell me, are you a Schwartz's guy or are you the Maine guy?
I have to say that it's very contentious that I'm a Schwartz. Whenever I was just there last year, and I was just went to Schwartz's like 3 days in a row, and people were like making fun of me, and I'm like, no, I want. I want it. This is before COVID. I said, I didn't even know what COVID was. I said, I want to get, if like, that's what COVID is Schwartz's. Like, you're going to catch something if you go to Schwartz's enough.
We can end the interview right there. I think we got the soundbite. That's what COVID is. It's Schwartz's.
Dude, Barbie Barn, you know, I went to Western Ontario. So it was like,
it was
all about, you know, the hashish came in from Montreal. This is before, this is dating you. So Montreal was very integral to the Canadian college system because that's where the hash came up through.
Imagine that it still is. I like to think that it's retained some of its former glory.
Cast dispersion on Montreal, but that's what I know Montreal for. And obviously I grew up hating Montreal as a Leaf fan, but then when you get to college age, you realize that Montreal is better than Toronto.
Montreal, they're both great in different ways. I say this as somebody who, I don't know, like semi-enthusiastically moved to Toronto. And I really love both cities for different reasons. I think Montreal is a little bit like Never Never Land from Peter Pan, right? It's the world where you never have to grow up. And so many people don't.
Yeah.
It's
a little
really
bit like
not-
Florida meets cold weather meets Texas. Meets France, meets...
That's right. And there's a high degree of cultural exchange between those two places, you know, any Quebecers. That's undoubtedly true.
But the food...
Well, you know, the food...
The food's
food,
so
well,
good.
Hey, Toronto also has great food. That is... I don't think that is actually a point of... maybe you can call it a point of rivalry between the two cities, but I'd give them both an A grade. You know, they're both unbelievable places to eat for different reasons.
Yeah, Center Street Deli is great for smoked meat in Toronto, too.
Where's that? I've never been.
It's way up north in Jewish country. Like,
I never go there. I'm a south of Bloor guy. I'm young.
Oh my god! Yeah. That's like going to the States for you. You might as well just go to Cantor's or New York.
Completely.
So that was a little bit of background, but I want to get into the work background. So
what are we going to talk about? Tell me what you want to talk about.
Because we're going to start out at social capital. If that's okay. How did you end up at social capital?
Okay, so this is a great story. I had previously, you know, I got into tech world in general in an interesting way. I started out, you know, not in tech at all, right? I don't have a software or an investing background originally. I went to grad school in neuroscience. I was doing work on chronic pain and left grad school at some point to go start my own startup. And that's how I got into this world at all. And as I was doing so along the way, I started writing a newsletter, you know, like mouthing off on the internet, as you know. And through that, I ended up writing a blog post about Dropbox saying, hey, you know, this is sort of at the peak where Dropbox had just raised one of its big rounds. This was in 2015, saying, oh, this business is so great. And I remember writing a post just saying like, hey, like, this is all fantastic and they're a great product and I use it all the time. But I just don't think files are that strategically important anymore going forward. I think that on the one hand, you have all these chat-based communication tools like Slack, who was early on at the time, are starting to grow more strategically important. And on the other hand, you have these platforms like AWS starting to really, you know, take over a lot of the enterprise workloads and changing the way we think about this. And so I just basically threw out there, I said, you know, I think Dropbox is, you know, not so strategically important. I give them a thumbs down and provocatively titled this Dropbox, the first dead decacorn. I learned an important thing about the internet, which is if you title your posts in the most incendiary way possible and just create sides and force people to take one, usually you will get a lot more interest in what you're writing than if you are fair and generally, you know, if you are a good actor and fair and supportive of everyone, then people will generally ignore your posts. But if you really create sides and just generally act like, you know, like like you want to start a war, then people will tend to support you in that effort. So
that's worked all its way right up to the White House.
That's right. And, you know, and it really worked me all the way up to another sort of master of that strategy, who's Chamath. You know, somewhat after that, Chamath, I heard, you know, from Ray, you know, Chamath's deputy at Social Capital, reached out and said, hey, you know, Chamath wants to talk to you. Come down to Palo Alto. He wants to see you. So I said, you know, this is interesting. I sort of knew who Chamath was. I said, you know, that's great. I'm getting married in a couple months. I've got a lot of things going on. He says, no, you have to come down. So I said, okay. So I went down, had two of, I want to say, the most bizarre interviews of my life with Chamath and with the rest of the gang over at Social Capital. And then, you know, figured like, hey, like something really special is happening here. You know, I want to be a part of it.
Oh, that's cool. So the meeting with Bizarro went well.
Yeah, it was really interesting. I remember so after maybe, I want to say close to an hour of just having this really strange but fascinating interaction with Chamath, he asked me at the end of the hour, he says, okay, tell me about water. You know, I don't know anything about water, right? I'm not a, I don't know anything about any of the aspects about water. So I sort of think about it for a second and I start to stammer something non-intelligently. And then Chamath cuts me off and says, okay, good. Clearly you don't know anything about water. Come back in 2 weeks and tell us about water. You know, that's your homework. So I thought, oh boy, like that's an interesting challenge. So I went home, I went back to Canada and talked to some people who knew stuff about water and tried to think critically about a couple interesting theses and came back and presented it to the whole team.
Oh my Lord.
You know, I had a good idea here, which is said, you know,
was your idea to invade Canada with some Ambien?
Well, the idea here was that, like, look, you know, like, while I have your attention here, you know, here are some interesting thoughts I have about what I think you should do at Social Capital. And I gave them my little spiel. And then Chamath basically said, like, okay, you know, give us a minute. And then he says, like, okay, cool, you work for us. And then he told me later at dinner, he's like, yeah, your water thesis was really stupid, but I like that other stuff you said, so we hired you.
I love that. I mean, so.
So there you go.
That was just kind of like a rando thing. He sent you on a journey and you did the work, but he really just wanted your opinions and thoughts.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a mystery to Chamath's method and his madness, right? But, you know, the thing with Chamath, and I've said this, I think, consistently over the past long while through these various different chapters of what he's been up to, is that he's right a lot, right? He really is, right? Mm-hmm. You've seen this, right? You know, he's wrong a lot, too, but I'd say on balance, it's worked out for him.
Yeah, I think it's kind of like your title, meaning he's putting money on the line. You were putting traffic on the line. You were making a traffic bet based around your opinion because he didn't have money on the line. He's doing both. He's like instigating, but also putting money on the line. And I think the younger crew loves it. Listen, I didn't know if, like, he's kind of like the new Kramer. And I've always been saying, you know, it's kind of like what, you know, they'd anoint the next Jordan or they anoint the next Tiger Woods or Jack Nicklaus. And you're always like, well, that's a death to that. I would have never picked him as someone that on StockTwits, people like are buying his specs. Like I thought the audience on StockTwits, I thought I knew them well enough to go, oh, they're not going to buy into this nonsense. They're just going to get hosed.
You know, he was really perceptive a couple years ago, understanding, right? He says, you know what? I am a compelling product. People like what I have to say. I should be a retail product. You know, a SPAC is a way to do that, right? Like, it's so simple, but it's right. You know,
my wife just said it. I was explaining her SPACs on the way here. I'm going to talk to Alex about SPACs. And she was like, she's a bankruptcy attorney. So she picked it up in 2 seconds. She goes, this is just a better way to do a fund.
Well, so the funny thing about SPACs, as you know, right, is that SPACs, you know, like, I remember at least, so Chamath sat us down, you know, at one point at All Hands and said, let me tell you about this thing we're going to do. We're going to do a SPAC. And then he told, none of us really knew what a SPAC was. So he told us all about it. Then I went home to Canada and I'm chatting about this with random people and they're like, oh yeah, we know what SPACs were. Yeah. I did a SPAC in my co-op semester at Waterloo. We took a fake mining company public.
Yeah.
Like,
there's it's all mining, all scams. 24/7, 365.
It's, you know, Chris Dixon's, the next great thing will start out looking like a toy and you just modify it slightly. It's like the next great liquidity event will start out looking like a scam.
Oh, I love that. Hang on. I'm writing that down. Let's mark that down ASAP. The next
mark that down and then we'll come back to it. We'll talk about Bitcoin later.
So Alex, this is exactly it. You know, the perfect storm for SPACs right now, creativity, perfect yin yang, money up to yin yang, a negligent financial president in the White House. Not that anybody, if you have
good
intentions.
Do you think it would make that much of a difference if you had someone else?
Oh, there's going to be so many scams. There's going to be so many scams. But what I was going to say is, in a world where your late stage growth financing was Masa's money versus a SPAC, a SPAC's way better.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, Matt Levine had, I think, as he often does, has sort of, I think, the right approachable way to think about this, which is to say, look, you know, like he says, I never understood SPACs until WeWork. And then I perfectly understood the point of SPACs. Right? He says, look, you're WeWork, right? You declare that you are going to become a public company. And then you say, all right, there is a huge amount of uncertainty as to what we're worth, as to whether any of this is real. Some people absolutely believe it. Other people don't. We're going to go through the IPO process and see how it shakes out. Now, it turns out that it broke not in favor of what WeWork wanted, right? But imagine if you could have just found a SPAC who supported what you were doing and then negotiated once and then got it done, right? And locked in a price and went public, got the money. What a different world we could be in. Imagine.
Yeah. Starts out looking like, dude, you nailed it. I am so bullish on creativity and the markets, and we are randomly, because of COVID, Robinhood, eToro, Stripe, Plaid, Alpaca, like some of my investments, we are in a phase where Davy Barstool, stock
splits, right.
Twitter. We are in a world where if you're not doing a SPAC, you may not be working hard enough.
Let me ask you this. Who is your number one pick to launch a SPAC? Not who do you think is likely to, but who do you most want to raise a SPAC for pure fun value?
Oh, for pure, I want to see that person raise a SPAC, or I would back that SPAC?
No, like I want to
see
that
person raise a SPAC. That would be a great game show. I'd back that
SPAC. I'd back that SPAC. Oh,
I'd tap that SPAC.
Backthatspac.com. Get the URL.
Hey, Knut, you got another job. Get over to GoDaddy and get a couple of those things.
Got it.
Oh, you're there. So obviously, you know, it's Adam Bain and Chamath. I have to say that they're the early lead, because here's what I like about Chamath. If you can get him around the right product, because I've introduced, full disclosure, I've introduced Adam and Chamath to a couple ideas. But what I like about him, and I would pick Chamath over Barstool, but both of those guys, is that Chamath has a much more technological view, vision, and a broader sense. And he's willing to go on TV. I think if you're not willing to go promote, you can't do this. Off the bat, they have to be a promoter. So Chamath and Dave Portnoy first. Stylistically, I don't like either, but I would still go with Chamath just because the ability to go to Wall Street and raise the money, because the pipe part is the really hard part, really. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, you take out all the fun, you still got to do the hard raise and the pipe, et cetera, et cetera. So you got to go with Chamath. But I'm involved in a few more and thinking through myself. I'd like to bet on myself to do one, just because my wife thinks it's a good idea. And if she blesses
it. You heard it here first.
Yeah. Like, trust me. Like, Ribbit just did one. Mickey at Ribbit. I think that's genius. Mm-hmm. And that kind of got my brain going a little bit more.
The idea of the focused SPACs, right? Where it's not, I'm going to buy any company, or I'm going to buy a mature unicorn. Who told him to say mature unicorn? That's pretty funny.
Oh, my God.
But, like, I love the idea of saying, I'm going to do a fintech SPAC, right? Like, it is my field of expertise, right? We know the 30 companies backwards and forwards. You know, let's get one of them. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah. So that's what I'm working on, to be honest. And I'm working on one other vertical. And, you know, my podcast started out as, you know, in the middle of a panic. And the idea was, well, I'm not panicked. It's too late. Should have panicked in January when Wuhan was getting built. Can't panic in March. Now we're in it together. Let's think through the other side of this. And what I got completely, I don't think anybody on my show in the first 50 podcasts over the first month and a half got right, was that we'd be NASDAQ all-time highs and Shopify would be 1,000 and Amazon would be 3,000. Anybody who says that's lying. So I, you know, and on Twitter, you know, anybody honest is like, oh my God, like you got at least we didn't crash. You got that right. So now here we are in August and I'm like, not bearish, but I'm like, well, okay. Like didn't predict this world, same president, same disease, country still shut down for the most part, no sports. So if you had told me all the news headlines today and then told me where the NASDAQ was, I would have fucking punched you in the face.
That's right. You can't predict the future. You can't even predict the present.
Good point. So the best VC is like looking 6 months ahead at best, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think with Chamath, so I'll stick with Chamath because it's boring, but it would be me. I think it's just like, who should people invest in themselves? So knowing what I know at my age and knowing what I know now about the job of leading a SPAC at the beginning, because in the end, you bring in a company that's going to be the CEO, like really, right? Mm-hmm. So, and so it's kind of like a part-time job for the first 2 years and what I've learned, right? You've got to work really hard, but it's not, you're not going to be the CEO forever. It's Chamath not running Virgin Galactic.
No, he's the chairman.
So who would you do?
I've been thinking about this. Well, my first answer is Barry Diller. Imagine.
Oh, yeah. He never loses. Right. Good point.
First of all, he never loses. Second of all, right, when all the SPAC talk started, he basically just said, like, well, IAC has a pretty good track record of picking good companies. Why don't we trade at a premium like this? Like, why don't I just call us a SPAC, right? Like, why don't we, like,
oh my
God,
go to so smart.
Made me thinking, like, man, you know, that's... So that's my answer. I'm going Barry.
Great answer. Brian Norgaard, who's going to listen, would say the same thing. He worked at Tinder. You don't bet against Barry. And you're right. IAC
right.
is a roll-up, like a digital
that's
roll-up.
Right.
In a world of digital versus a world of mining and physical, SPACs make sense.
Well, tell me about what you think about SPACs as a roll-up vehicle. Because so far, we've mostly been talking about them about this single purpose. I'm going to take one large tech company public.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
like, is there, you know, like, what else? You know, like... Could you,
well,
could you
makes more sense into, to me. I
could
don't
you
think...
SPAC into existence a new Constellation software?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. That's there's some of those out there that are trading way lower. I'm not going to share the ticker symbols because they're smaller caps, but I totally think it's about a roll-up. I think it'll be hard to compete in the single purpose. You know, we're going to buy one company. Like, is it going to be SoFi? Is it going to be whatever? I mean, you can predict the eight companies that everybody's pitching. So I think there's more to the Diller model where you are doing the Constellation. America's loves a conglomerate. America loves constellations. We're not China. We're more art than style. And I think a digital roll-up is so much easier than a physical roll-up. Look at Thrasio. You must know about Thrasio.
Mm. Yeah. Mm.
To me, it's genius. What do you think of Thrasio?
Oh, like, look, I'm not the right person to ask about it, but yeah, thank you for deflecting.
So Thrasio is just buying Amazon businesses. I know what they do.
I just can't really. You can explain to the audience. Sorry.
So in a world where Thrasio exists, in a world where Amazon, Shopify, Walmart, everybody, and these walls exist, no different than the financial walls before Robinhood and Telegram and Twitter and StockTwits. In a world where that exists, I think a roll-up, like the Thrasio of the world is in the early days, these digital malls, these superpower roll-ups that take on the North Star with a constellation, you know, from 1,000 angles of attack.
Tell me about the digital mall, because, you know, at Shopify, we think about every aspect of commerce you can think of. And one of those is sort of this idea of like, well, malls clearly serve a lot of different purposes. Tell me about, I mean, I'm always interested in anybody who thinks about malls. Tell me what you think about malls and digital malls and whatever their equivalent is.
Well, I mean, we go back to the 70s, right? With the movies, every teenage movie was about a mall to now they're a punchline. But, you know, it's just about economies of scale and trust and fashion and style and taste. So, you know, a digital mall doesn't mean the same as a physical mall. It just means helping these constellation, these DTC companies, these smaller brands get scale to make them the best company they could be. And whoever builds the prettiest, you know, mall and can help their mall get the best distribution, which means location doesn't matter, as distribution's the new location. You know, I haven't thought about it that much, but that's kind of how I think about it.
Well, it's CAC is the new rent.
I didn't know that, but I'm writing that down. CAC, I like that. Yes.
Somebody smarter than me said that.
Okay, so I'll steal that. But CAC is the new rent, right? Like, so, like with Manscaped, these guys figured out how to do what Dollar Shave Club and what Harry's did on a fraction of the dollar. So I think the new world that we live in, the style and the art will be, how do I get to a billion, like the old Instagram way? Like when Instagram started, I was like, oh, there'll be a million Instagram ideas. Like it'll launch a ton of unicorns that try and do this with as little money as possible. And then we got SoftBank. We got the opposite. So, or T. Rowe Price and Fidelity doing late stage deal, boring. And so hopefully... And it probably won't work out this way. Hopefully, my hope is that the creativity and style, like a Substack, more Substacks, like the creativity and style of an open web where CAC is the new rent, will create these, you know, amazing creatively lean roll-ups. And so the difference between a digital roll-up, hopefully, and the old physical world is the ability to go wider and leaner.
I like it.
Okay, good. Well, then, if you agree with me, we're ending the interview right there. Thanks, everybody.
All right, we set a new record. Folks, check out backthatstack.com.
So tell me about Shopify Money. How did they get you to come to Shopify?
Okay, so I guess the backstory for me around Shopify is that I know, you know, being Canadian, Shopify is like, you know, for several years, it was sort of this vague, mysterious company out of Ottawa, right? Which was doing interesting things, but they were kind of under the radar unless you were a merchant or you were in that world. But most people just knew them as like, oh, this is where my developer friends are going to work, right? That was kind of the way through which we kind of heard that Shopify was growing and becoming this sort of swamp monster of a company, right? It has no consumer brand really at the time. Like a lot of people didn't really know who Shopify was outside of in tech or like in that industry. And then at some point, you know, they quietly turn into this unbelievable company, right? Just they're the perfect counterexample to, oh, all the money gets made in the private markets. Like it's all about access to deal flow. Like, you know, it's like, yeah, right. But I first became, you know, like more closely thinking about Shopify when Kaz, who runs Shopify Money, Kaz Najarian, he and I had gotten to know each other out in California. He was doing his own startup at the time, Cash, and then he was at Facebook doing payment-related things. And so Kaz and I had gotten to know each other. We had talked a lot about the future of how we fund all of this stuff, right? We had really gotten to know each other in the context of social capital, trying a lot of new stuff in terms of funding entrepreneurs, in terms of a lot of, this growing realization that the internet was going to happen to the fundamental way that we get resources into the hands of entrepreneurs who then go do good things with it, right? I think we kind of understood, right? You were at Social Capital. We were looking around and thinking like, you know, like the basic setup of the VC firm is kind of old, right? This is, you know, somebody who was a partner at a VC firm in the 80s could have time traveled to, you know, the Kleiner Perkins today or somewhere. And, you know, within an hour, he'd know his way around. And I say he because they were all he's at that point in time. So, you know, at Social Capital in this context, right, we were thinking a lot about this and saying, you know, first of all, right, for entrepreneurs who are coming to us and they have parts of their business really figured out, right? Let's say, you know, just to give an example, like Stuart from Slack could like come down and go raise money. And we look at just the incredible machine that Slack had built. They made viral enterprise software. So he would come and he'd say it's remarkable, right? So he would come and just say like, hey, like I'm raising more money to go grow this thing. And we'd look and we would say like, okay, so you have the acquisition model for these customers understood down to the decimal places, right? You understand this so well. And yet you're coming out here and you're going to tell us a story and we're going to like the story. And then we're going to give you a check for money in exchange for equity in your company. And then you're going to put that check into the bank account. And then you're going to spend it later on acquiring users that then pay back pretty regularly. We're like, okay, we've optimized perfectly for the wrong way to do this, right? This is not how this should work. And yeah, you know, I've written about this a lot, right? The sort of the all equity funding model of accelerating these software companies is interesting because it's like, look, like in the rest of the world, selling your own equity is not a sign of absolute strength, right? Like that's not really what that communicates. There are other ways to raise funding for a business, but in tech, for various reasons, that is what you do. And the most important reason is that if you do anything else, it is a signal that things have gone wrong. Right. Like that is a powerful set of guidelines, like keeping people on the straight and narrow in terms of like the way that we fund these businesses. We're looking at this and like, this is ridiculous.
That's a narrative too. The tech crunches and all the VC websites. So it's a narrative.
It's a narrative. Well, narrative is powerful, first of all. And also the way that things work is a powerful vehicle, right? Because look, it's like it almost never pays for an individual founder or an individual VC to try and reinvent the wheel when the industry collectively is very good at solving this problem, which is how do we, you know, ramp up across several rounds of funding and how do we ramp up investment into a company where we don't know the ultimate value of what we're building, we don't know how much capital they're going to have to raise on the way there. And so we can't really know what any of this is worth. Like we can suspect that the answer is a lot, but like who knows how much this is worth? Like it's very hard to know. And over decades, right? The VC industry has gotten really good at creating this ecosystem where, you know, I like to say, like, the best trick the VCs ever pulled was calling it valuation and not price. Right? There's no valuation going on here. There's no, like, calculating to any degree of certainty at all, right? Like, what, you know, in a conventional sense, like, you're not like saying, like, okay, I've DCF'd this company and this to within plus or minus 5 to 10% is what this business is worth. No, like, what matters is upward trajectory, right? What matters when you invest in a company is not, I think that 25 million pre is fair value for this company. What matters is if they hit their milestones, there will be a next round, and the next round will be higher than that, right? Yes. So I want to get in here at a lower number. Right? Like, that's what matters. Anyway, this is all a digression to say, like, look, you know, like, this has worked out really well, and it's a strong ecosystem level force. But nonetheless, individual entrepreneurs who are producing incredible businesses are selling their equity for way too cheap, right? Mm-hmm. Like, look at Zoom, right? Look at, you see a company like Zoom, they're like, okay, this is a home run. Everybody inside can see it. So why are they selling equity when they know that that is just, like, such expensive cost of capital relative to what they should be getting? This could be different. Then we look at the second part of the equation and say, okay, what about all the parts of the business, and what about all of the businesses that are not yet in Slack-like execution mode? Like, then we're thinking, it's like, okay, this is also a little frustrating to see all of these entrepreneurs, you know, come to us, go fundraise, go back to their offices, and then struggle in parallel to build the same shit, right, and make the same mistakes all in parallel. It's like, people, you know, your businesses are not these unique special snowflakes. Like, 80% of them is made of roughly the same stuff.
Jewish people have a word for that. We call it goyim.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, like, so we're thinking, like, hey, like, surely this would make sense if, you know, like, you know, we're sitting here at Social Capital. We're thinking, like, we have part of the Social Capital team, you know, if you look at, like, growth, right? If you look at, say, like, hey, who is the user acquisition team and what do they know about building a growth engine for a company, right? Turns out the answer is a lot, right? They're really good at this. Like, it's like, we should be making this and we should give it to you for free. Why give it to you for free? Because it makes our investment into you better, right? Because it makes your company better. So, you know, we put these two things together, which is to say, like, for things that are working really well, we should just, like, you should never have to raise money for this in the way we currently do. It should just be funded. And then the second half of it is like, okay, for everything that isn't working really well, why don't the people who know how to make this make it for you and get it to you as easily as possible, because it's in their interest to do so, because then they can just fund you more successfully, right? Like, you have the inputs and you have the outputs. Let's put them together. So all of this is coming around to a long way to say, right, that... And here's where we're tying this back to Shopify, right? Kaz and I got to know each other. We became friends. We started talking about this general view of things, of saying, like, look, you know, like, it's going to change. Like, the way that we get resources into the hands of entrepreneurs is going to change. Fast forward a few years, right? I've left Social Capital. I'm back at home in Toronto. I have a kid. I take some time off. Have a nice time. Write some newsletters. I get a call from Kaz. He says, hey, I should talk to you. I'm running Shopify Money. You know that idea that you guys had, that you guys tried to do? You know, we're doing it. You know, we're doing it with a different set of entrepreneurs, right? These are Shopify merchants we're talking about, not Silicon Valley founders. But it's the same idea, which say, like, look, we understand so much about these businesses because they're built on Shopify. Mm-hmm. And when we give you the money, you then go use it on other Shopify products. Mm-hmm. Right, this is starting to sound awful familiar. Right,
is that Shopify products in the store, in the App Store? You mean?
No, or just like it's like what you do with the, it could be in the App Store. It could be on selling more products through your store. It could be in expanding new channels. It could be in your marketing.
Your
it could
CAC,
be
any of these things. Yada yada yada.
Yeah, it's but nonetheless, it's just like, hey, like a lot. I think a lot of people have the impression from the outside that the reason why Shopify works so well is because we have all this data, right? People use the word data, like, oh, you must have so much data on your merchants. It's like, I mean, we do have data, but that's not really the point, right? The point is that because we can get such an incredible integration together, not just on money, right? Not only on products like cash advances and on payments and on helping you manage the finances of your business and things like that, but just everywhere across the entire store, right? because we can integrate all of these things so tightly together, we can lower the learning curve of how much you need to know in order to run a great business. That's the goal for us, right? Is to make it easier and easier and easier for you to not have to worry about all of the problems and all the stumbling blocks and all of the hardships that traditionally you'd have to go through as you learn the hard way how to be a merchant. Right? Like, so we would love more than anything to just productize some of that away and let you be creative, right? And let you do what differentiates you as a business.
So is Shopify a software company or a fintech company?
We're a software company. Let me ask you this. Like, I'm sure that everybody inside Shopify would say, like, look, like, we do money things. But, like, again, Shopify is a big place, right? And money is just one of the many, many, many parts of it. So I'm going to say, look, we're a software company. We are always going to be. That's in our DNA, is to just make really, really great software. That being said, we want to make as many conduits as possible for merchants to get the resources that they need and then go win. So, does that make us fintech-ish? I don't know. Sure. But
yeah. Well, you know, and Treese and all these guys, everything's fintech. And I like shake my head because, wait a minute, I'm not that smart. And I was in fintech a long time ago. That moots the whole idea.
Right.
I mean, whereas I don't know how to code, so software still must be the thing. So it's bugging me that everybody says fintech is, I'm glad you answered software because then I'd be more pissed.
Look, we're a software. Well, you know, I like to say that like Shopify was a no code company before no code became cool and trendy, right? Like, you don't have to be a software engineer to use Shopify, right? There's some irony in that. If you look at, I think one of the original attempts to do this was WordPress, right? WordPress was also this great idea of saying any individual should be able to create their presence on the internet and then leverage it to its great potential.
Yeah. Love WordPress, so mad at them for not being public and letting you know,
my blog alexnaiko.com is on WordPress, right? But then somehow along the way you needed a team of engineers to get anything done on WordPress, right? So I don't know. And you know, I think that if you look across Shopify, right, Shopify has to solve problems and enable great commerce for a huge range of merchants, right? And I would say that there are, like, you know, you can segment them infinitely, but let's say there are three categories, right? Category one is small mom and pop merchant who does a small amount of GMV a year and just wants something where we can basically tell them, here's an unbelievable set of products. This is better than anything you've ever seen. It meets your use cases, no problem.
Yeah.
The second category is like big retailers, right? So if you look at, these are Shopify Plus customers who like have their online stores. These are traditional names that you know, right? Who are saying like, hey, we have an online store. We want to use Shopify's to power some of this. And then the third category is the most interesting, I think, is these are like YouTubers who have 10 million subscribers, right? And do flash sales for millions and millions of dollars, right? These are large retailers, but they are not, you know, professional businesses in the sense that they don't have 15 years of accumulated know-how and preferences, right? Like, these are people who have just gotten recently very large followings and very powerful ability to sell stuff, right? And where we can power them up fast, right? And we can get them to sell stuff fast. And that's cool, right? Like,
that was the miracle that Shopify allows. It's just a miracle. All this stuff is a miracle. COVID's a nightmare.
Instantaneous scaling.
Shopify's a miracle. Don't ever let these guys say the word fintech at Shopify. It bugs me that everybody's using that word. You know what fintech is? MasterCard and Visa. They're like old. When I think of fintech, I think of just grumpy walls. Like,
you think of
D-Hawk. People just ripping people off. I guess Stripe is the ultimate fintech company. I think Square doesn't do it for me, but Stripe is probably the ultimate new fintech company. I think WordPress was the ultimate no-code whatever thing original, like 2005. And I guess, you know, they let Wix steal the valuation and thunder with their IPO and crappy product. So, you know, there's an art to this thing. You can't just have the best product and the best code. You also have to understand how markets work. And I think Shopify has just done a magnificent job of, you know, confusing the most, but pleasing the most, right? Like, investors don't understand it. The users love it. It's just an amazing story.
Toby is a masterful leader at controlling the narrative in a very particular way, right? Not just externally, but also internally too, right? I think he's a remark. I don't want to kiss ass too much, but like, you know what CEO, I think Toby is a good comparable to think about Toby is Zuck, actually. Like, they're both very, very detail oriented, right? Like, it is not infrequent that, you know, like, Toby will sit in a product review and he will know more than anybody else in the room, right? Despite, you know, right. spending some small fraction of his time on it. Like, this is not an uncommon occurrence. He's, you know, he's very detail oriented. He's very opinionated, right? And he has taste, right? Mm-hmm. That, I think, is the important part of, and, you know, this, Shopify is Toby's company, right? And Toby has a particular taste about how he wants the future of being a merchant to go, right? And what success means and how to best achieve that. And taste is so important, right? When you are a platform.
Where are you going with this? Right? Yep, keep going. Keep going.
When you are trying, you know, when you are trying to create a way for merchants to express their brand and themselves and their creativity and convey, you know, a sense of identity in a product that, you know, for the one, makes a buyer happy, and two, can command a gross margin, right? Because they create happiness. Then if you are a platform that has no sense of taste, then you will lose. You will not win. Right. And I think, yeah, there are a lot of, again, if you look at what not having taste looks like, it means you are just a less good version of Amazon. Right. That's what it means. Yeah. Right. Amazon has no taste, but they're also like the best executing company this century. Right. So they win. Right. But in order to compete against Amazon, you either need to have taste or you need to be OK with losing. That's it.
It brings me full circle to what you said, like a digital, like in this world of SPACs, you know, in an old world of financial leverage, this goes to social capital and social leverage, mm-hmm. right? I was always like, you know, Shema stole my name, is that financial leverage that ended in 08 with the crash and Bitcoin came after and FinTech and Stripe and Shopify and Prime is, you know, building, just stack debt. Right. Mm-hmm. Then we went to this equity world. Right. And now we're going to go back to this. We went too far down the equity road, probably now with the ending point being probably would have been Masa, if not for COVID and now all the new layer of money printing, which is probably we're probably at the end of this. Right. To the era where you're talking about debt. You know, I had Bill Libby on my show at Upper 90, mm-hmm. Where it's not just about debt, because debt is a really good idea, but it's how you apply the debt. So there has to be, and it's about design. So the next great SPACs are not so much about bulk, about just layering shit on. It's about style, taste, you know, the old swoosh model. It's not going to happen overnight. It can happen faster, you know, because you don't have to fly to Asia and set up a factory yourself like Phil Knight did. So the next swooshes are going to come much faster than it took Blue Ribbon, whatever his name was, for the first 10 years. So so that's what I'm saying about SPACs. In a digital world, it's going to come down more to creativity and design because of the software, not so much about how much can you bulk up fast.
That's right. I would love to see a little ETF or something of somebody with good judgment to just say, I'm going to make an ETF of the companies that have the best taste.
So I have an 8-to-80 thing and everybody's asking me to do, because it's basically that, right? It's the best brands and you buy them on 20% dips and you just leave it alone for 50 years. You're generally founder led, you know, so it's a very popular list and it just doesn't change that often. Because, you know, it's under 15 companies and I'm calling, you know, lately I've been thinking about Zillow. There's always like something to take away and something to add because it's slowly become more digital than physical. Like, you know, I love Nike and Disney and they're the last two crossover, well, McDonald's, but you know, in an end, like, should I have any physical companies on my 8-to-80 list in a world of, well, it's a headache to own a physical business.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, Art. Who's your favorite brand?
I think
What's your favorite brand?
You know, I have to say there's just too many, but my favorite right now in the elegance of hiding is Tencent, right? Like, is it Epic? Fortnite? Meaning, look what they've done, right? So there's them. They're the first kind of like conglomerate.
You got to love the conciseness of the, I forget who observed this. Somebody on Twitter said like, oh, it turns out that like SoftBank for gaming worked better than SoftBank.
Yeah.
Right.
So Tencent is just brilliant. Like no one knows they own Snapchat or, you know, a piece of Snapchat and Epic and, you know, obviously WeChat and WePay. So I would say them just because they're the modern version. And I think what's his name, who I just heard his podcast, said that I forget the term he used, that the future, but Tencent's up there and I own a lot of Tencent. And then I think, you know, Nike, just because of the struggle, right? And no one could do that again. There's just, people don't understand. You kids today don't really understand what it was like in the 70s and 60s to build what he built, right? The physical You know, Zuckerberg may be great, but he didn't have to go do the shit that Phil Knight had to do.
No, it's a different struggle.
And everybody should have to read Shoe Dog. Why are kids in school reading anything but Shoe Dog? You know, Huck Finn is cool, but like, read Shoe Dog. Entrepreneurs need to appreciate what that last entrepreneur before the internet had to do to build the greatest brand. So I have to give Phil Knight the nod. Just because he partied, he left his family, he had to go to Asia and build factories out of nothing. He had to just disappear off the grid with no tether, no chat, no phone, you know? So who's yours?
I'm thinking. I don't have a final answer for you, Ned, but you know who is top of mind for me right now? You know what's a great brand? The NBA. NBA is a fantastic brand, right? Like, compare the NBA to, you know, pro hockey right now, or really any of the other sports franchises for that matter, in terms of how they've been able to express this absolute dominance of the cultural narrative that, in my opinion, even football can't match right now. Right? You know, football is supposed to be the biggest. It's the big heavyweight in the room. But like, I have to say, I hand it to Adam Silver and everybody else in the NBA that, like, what an incredible export. It's the new export of the American way, right? Remember in Last
Culture,
Dance,
yeah, it's
showing,
culture. But Nike,
Jordan,
here's what I'm going to argue with on Nike. I don't love the product.
Mm-hmm.
So playoff NBA, sure. Regular season, it's like the old Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in the airplanes. And you're dead.
That's right.
My dad says you're lugging it up the court half
I
the
drag
time.
My ass up and down the court every night.
So I feel like there's a lot of truth still to an 80-game season. So the product is not the best. They package it phenomenally, and Shaq and TNT do a great job of packaging the humanity of basketball and the struggle and the laughs. So, yeah.
Okay, and the Last Dance, right? I have to call it, right? The Last Dance, everybody watched it, right? How genius
phenomenal.
Of it was in the very beginning of the first episode, they're showing Mike get off the plane in Paris, France, right?
Paris,
he's going in the TV studio room, and they're like, "Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Jordan," and everybody goes wild in French, right? And you just get this sense of awe of like, oh man, right? He's the whole world, right? Like, and what a perfect way to introduce that show. So kudos to whoever edited that. That was a great choice.
So we haven't hit a few things, so, and I know you got to go. So this is too much to digest because obviously I love Shopify and I didn't spend much time there, but we've covered Shopify money a little bit. We've covered your background, social capital. We've covered SPACs. We've covered debt financing a little bit, and there's a lot we could talk about there. But I want to just quickly, and then we'll talk about Canada next. I want to quickly end with crypto. Where does crypto fit into Shopify money and your thinking, and what's your general thought?
So real quick, I can tell you something that I spend a lot of time on every day is our membership in the Libra Association. So Libra is a really, really interesting phenomenon. I don't know if it's earned the right to call itself a phenomenon yet. Like, Michael Jordan's a phenomenon. Libra isn't there yet. But so Libra, if you remember, right, got spun up a couple of years back by a whole bunch of organizations, mostly Facebook, who said, look, you know, like, there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in, call it the blockchain world, if you want to call it, or the crypto world, where I say, like, crypto means cryptography, right? In the sense that, like, it is really powerful to be able to give someone the ability to sign their identity, right, with a public-private key pair and say, I'm me. Let me sign this. What can we build on top of that ability, right? And so on top of that, one way that's not unfair to think about the origins of Libra is to say, like, Facebook asked, how much of the world's economy could we run on an Excel spreadsheet if we wanted to? Right. And if we let other people into that Excel spreadsheet, is that interesting? You know, this doesn't. But beneath that, right? So beneath that is a more interesting set of ideas, which say, like, look, you know, if you have one thing that Facebook does not lack, right, is extraordinarily talented developers with a very strong sense of what fundamental work could be done to make an interesting new way to do commerce and an interesting new way to prove identity and an interesting new way to do payments. So if you go on Libra.org and if you go poke around, what I encourage you to go read, if you're into crypto at all, is the Move white paper, right? So people over at Libra wrote a new programming language called Move, which says, hey, we want to make it really easy to write smart contracts and write little ways to store and express and send around value that fundamentally reflects properties that we want money to have, right? So it makes it very, very hard to duplicate a scarce resource, right? You know, one of the problems that Bitcoin solved very cleverly is something called the double spend problem, right? Hey, once you create a digital asset, what's to prevent me from copying it and spending it twice, right? What's to prevent, you know, all kinds of problems that you have with digital scarcity that let you not be able to make things like bearer instruments, right? They're super hard. So the MOVE programming language fundamentally is this way of saying like, hey, like if we really write a new way to make software with the assumption of the internet and the assumption of a whole bunch of companies around the table acting as validators and a whole bunch of people basically saying like, look, you can call it a blockchain or not. You can call it crypto or not. What's important about it is they said like, this is a really interesting way for more people to participate in a digital economy where people can prove they're them and then send around IOUs around that system, right? Actually engage in commerce. And I think they like to say, increase the perimeter of, you know, the formal economy, I believe, is a way they like to think about this. Now, somewhere along the way, that narrative got turned into Facebook wants to print their own money, which, as you can imagine, is a narrative that a lot of people want to hear because they have an idea of how they feel about Facebook or how they feel about this whole part of the world. Or this could, you know, and immediately, you know, the challenge that they ran into is how on earth do you launch this in a way that has any kind of regulatory blessing whatsoever? Right, because there are two paths in front of this project. Either they can do it legally and do it in a way that is compliant and blessed by regulators around the world, and if they can pull it off, this will be an unbelievably powerful asset. Or they could not do that, in which case it'll just be a really shitty version of every other crypto project, right? Except it'll just have, it'll be, you know, bogged down by its association with all these big tech companies, right? So Shopify was not one of the founding members of the association. We arrived late, but to us, you know, this is one of these opportunities where we look at this and we say like, okay, you know, like if this there's a lot of interesting stuff we can play around with. But the one thing we know for sure is that if this takes off, we need to be a part of it, right? Because this is really kind of fundamental to what we want to do in the world, right? If Libra actually succeeds in any of its missions, right, of making a better international way to send money around, or whether it's a better way to do digitally scarce identity for things like intellectual property, managing brands and things like that. Like all of these things are very consistent with what we want to do. So it's a great, it's overall, it's great fit. I'm having a lot of fun there. With crypto, aside from that, it's like, man, oh man, like there's interesting stuff going on right now. You know, what do you want to talk about in crypto land? I know you—
Are you just bullish directionally on Bitcoin, Ethereum?
I mean, look, yes. So let's put it this way. Like if you look, I own Bitcoin and nothing else. Okay. Yep. That's my real stance. So whatever I say, you can ignore and just look at what I hold. I think you could summarize my attitude towards Bitcoin in probably one sentence, which is, I believe Bitcoin is decentralized, but I realize that the price of Bitcoin in US dollars is anything but.
Interesting.
That is my stance, right? I think you can, if you look at sort of like the progression of learning about crypto, it's like initially, like you hear about Bitcoin, you're like, this is internet money, this sounds stupid. Then you learn more about it, and then you research it, and you learn about how like the proof of work and all the incentive systems and like what mining is. And then at some point something unlocks and you're like, okay, I get it. This is really cool, right? This is provable scarcity, right? This is like something that is a guaranteed store of value. There'll never be more than 21 million Bitcoins. That's really valuable. This is like gold, you know, like this is amazing. Then you learn more about it. And then you're like, okay. You know, the Hyman Minsky line, like stability is destabilizing, right? Like the Minsky theory of bubbles, right?
I love
like
that.
Yeah. Stability is destabilizing. It's like in crypto.
When you think it's fragile, it's not. I mean, just when you think anti-fragile.
Right. Well, stability is destabilizing this whole idea of like, hey, like, risks make us be cautious. When you're cautious, things go well. When things go well, we take more risks. When we take more risks, it gets destabilizing, right? The whole idea of, you know, the way that comes. You can say a similar type of thing in crypto, which is decentralization is centralizing, right? So let's look across like the Bitcoin universe, right? You say like, okay, like ownership of Bitcoins and what wallets they reside in and where unspent transaction outputs get sent around, all that stuff is decentralized. Like it works. It's like this miracle that it worked. It's really impressive. But let's look at all the things around Bitcoin, right? So first I'll look at mining, right? It's like, okay, well, there are a lot of economies of scale in purchasing and operating mining equipment. And if you look into this, that's like there is a lot of consolidation and verticalization of even like the supply chains behind making this mining equipment, where the more you read into this, the more you're going to be like, oh, right? This is controlled by like a handful of people.
Of course.
Second, if you look at the exchanges, right, the exchanges between U.S. dollars and Bitcoin, right, like these exchanges are quite scarce because the on-ramps into this stuff, it's very, very hard to be compliant, right? Yeah. Like it's very hard to have a real bank that will actually do real banking for you. So because of that, all of the non-bank exchanges have to be able to create these trading pairs, right? And they become very dependent on these sort of pseudo US dollar providers of USD pricing. And we can get all into Tether if you want, because like the Tether story is something where it's like, it is a conspiracy theory, but it's a conspiracy theory that I kind of believe, right? It's just like how much
need it to get to the next.
Yeah, that's the thing. So I don't want to get into that right now because that's a whole thing, but look it up. The third thing, which is, and this is sort of the most interesting part of what is happening with the future of Bitcoin, is if you look at scaling solutions, right? So I think, you know, if you're into crypto at all, the most important company that you need to know about is a company called Blockstream. Blockstream has been around for a long time. They're from Montreal originally. I knew them, a couple of them from way back then, right? They are a company that initially became known for this concept called sidechains, right? Which say like, hey, you know, I have blockchain A and I have blockchain B, where blockchain A might be the main Bitcoin net and blockchain B might be something else where it like scales more easily, right? But might be less trustworthy, for instance, right? It's like, can I peg them together and swap digital assets between them in a secure way so I can get the best of both worlds, right? And get the robustness of Bitcoin while have the ability to, let's say, like do lots of transactions really fast on the sidechain. So it turns out it's like, yes, you can. You actually can do this. It's very powerful. But what this means is that, you know, a lot of the liquidity around Bitcoin and a lot of the, you know, like the ability to avoid congestion on the Bitcoin network, which we're going to have to figure out how to do one way or another in order to scale this thing if it takes off, is being managed by these outside companies, right? So Blockstream is a business, right? Like they have an enormous amount of power around not Bitcoin itself, but the ability of Bitcoin to be usable, right? Is again becoming more centralized than people want to talk about, right? So again, I would sort of summarize this and to say, like, look, Bitcoin itself proper is decentralized, but the price isn't decentralized. The scaling isn't really so decentralized necessarily. A lot of the ecosystem around it, not so decentralized. So pick your poison, right? Like, maybe that's what's necessary to get it to the next level. It sure seems to be the case, but, you know, like, go in with your eyes open, right? Don't be surprised if, you know, for the traders, if you start seeing a lot of BARTs, right? If you know what I mean by the BARTs, where like the price just pumps way up and then gets held, and pump falls way back down. You see those
in a world where everybody's a billionaire, and by everybody, I mean a lot of people, and thousands of people could own the whole supply. Yeah, I think that's the biggest problem. It's like the Hunt brothers with silver. It's just not that big a market, and it's not, it may be decentralized, like you say, but it's owner occupied. It's a long way to go.
It's cool. Like, don't get me wrong.
It's so cool. And yeah. It's cool because it's working at some minimal level at this point, but it's got so much potential. And we need it. We need that toy right now because the gatekeepers.
What did we say? Right, the next great liquidity mechanism will start out looking like a scam.
Knut, remember that. That's our headline for this show. Alex, I got to have you back to talk about Canada and more Shopify, if that's okay. But like,
absolutely.
You know, I've taken enough of your time today.
Anytime. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for having me on the show.
This was as good as I imagined. I'm glad you're healthy up there in Toronto. And you know Matt Golden. Well. He was my first Canadian on the show, so you know Matt.
Absolutely. Oh, that's fabulous.
Yeah. So cool. Thanks for taking the time with us, and we'll get you back here soon.
All right. Thanks so much. Stay safe down there. I'll see you on Twitter.
See you on Twitter.
All right. Take care.
K-Nut.
Hey, I didn't get to ask my question.
Yeah, texting me. We're out of time.
Yeah, I did that.
Threw you under the bus.
I always have an auto text sent to you.
He's low on energy.
Yeah, I can tell.
Yeah. Next time we send him a Panic with Friends Adderall kit.
That and maybe a bag of Jolly Ranchers, the red ones.
Ooh, I forgot to ask him about my goddamn red.
Right.
Damn it.
Never mind. Next time.
note to self next time. Exactly. Moobs or Red Candy Shopify store. So he will definitely be part two. Everybody, this is Panic with Friends. Knut's my producer. Knut Jensen, this soft, silky voice. And you can find us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Or go to my blog, howardlinson.com. I have a daily free email newsletter about trends and markets. Thanks, K-Nut.
Thank you. And thank you to StockTwits.